Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 2005. This session is Beyond Words, Sojourners in the Wilderness. Part 2, God Has No Name, But the Joke's on Me. Presented by Fred Niedner in the Fireside Room. Disc number NIF-200502.
Good morning. My name is Fred Niedner, serving this week as Bible study leader. Since we have a slightly different group each day, I will do a mini introduction of the week each morning, or at least a brief explanation of a couple things. I've entitled the series Beyond Words, Wilderness Sojourns and Sojourners, and the Beyond Words part comes from the way I understand the word for wilderness in the Bible. Version of the word in Hebrew for word that means something like beyond words or the place where words fail or something like that. So it's times of transition, times when we're between meaningful parts of our lives and caught somewhere between one life and another. I also explained yesterday that given my own history at Holden, I am in the habit of starting sessions with alleged hilarity, which means that you can decide if it was true or successful, whether you're not. What I brought along this morning has to do with a theme that I'm going to develop, at least in the first part of this morning, about our callings coming not only from private experiences or determining in the aftermath of our lives what it is that we were drawn to, but the fact that our relationships form us and call us into the things that we do and the ways that we do them, into our vocations, actually. And what I brought along may make sense to you later on as something appropriate, or it may not. It's a letter to Ann Landers that I clipped from the newspaper years ago. And because we're at Holden, I must preface this by saying that both the characters in the letter have quirks, and it's not got anything to do with their gender, which quirkiness is which. Dear Ann Landers, I have been married to Dolores, not her real name, for 30 years. For the most part, we have had a good marriage, but Ann, there is something about Dolores that drives me crazy, and I don't know how much longer I can take it. On our wedding night, as we unpacked our things in the hotel honeymoon suite, Dolores pulled out of her luggage an accordion. I didn't even know that she played the accordion, much less that she took it with her everywhere. But she played on and on that evening through several rounds of Lady of Spain and some drinking songs with surprisingly ribald lyrics. I was stunned. I could never have guessed how important her accordion was to Dolores. To be frank, Anne, she doesn't play that well and only knows a few tunes. It is very hard to listen to. Here is the worst part. Dolores and I have never had much of a social life. In fact, our only real friends are Bernice and Murray. Whenever we get together, Dolores gets out her accordion, and Bernice and Murray join the act. Bernice clacks two spoons together to keep rhythm, and Murray makes hollow musical sounds by tapping on the top of his head while opening and closing his mouth to produce changes in tone. I am near the end of my rope, Anne. I love my wife, but I wish I never had to see Bernice and Murray again. How can I tell my wife this rascal is driving me crazy? signed Had It on Long Island. You've got to know how Ann responded.
Yeah.
But dear Had It, you've been truly wonderful. Please don't blow 30 years of sainthood by losing your temper because of her accordion playing, Dolores accordion playing. Surprise her with a dozen accordion lessons and several pieces of sheet music. Sorry, I can't think of a thing you can do about Bernice and Murray. So, I suppose any people in committed relationships could relate to the fact that we are all somewhat hard to live with. Yesterday, we did call narratives of one kind, recognized as call narratives, and I didn't really intend to spend quite as much time on those particular ones as we did, but I realized once we got started we could have spent a whole lot more on them. For example, it is so interesting to ponder the call narrative of Isaiah in Isaiah 6:1-4 as we did, and then to take a look at the second call narrative in the Isaiah corpus, the one that's in Isaiah 40, the one that's actually the call of the next Isaiah, the Isaiah of the exile, whose call comes in an unholy place, the one called to speak comfort rather than things that will drive people further and further into despair. And that prophet can't believe that those things are possible anymore, or that it's a job that prophet should have any more than the first Isaiah believed that he could do the task. But I'm going to let that go and go back to a different kind of way that the Bible depicts us as being called to certain things. I mentioned yesterday that we have a brief notice out there in the wilderness just prior to the text that sets our theme for the summer that relates Moses' marriage. And so I'd like us to start this morning at Exodus 2, verses 15 and following. And again, I'll preface this by saying I know that some of you have studied this group of stories that I'm going to do this morning very carefully, but I'm going to do it anyway, even though it's probably old turf for some of you. Moses has killed the Egyptian taskmaster and has had to flee now as a person on the lam, as it were. And we read, and I'll just read it myself. Moses fled from Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian and sat down by a well. The priest of Midian had 7 daughters. They came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. But some shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and came to their defense and watered their flock. When they returned to their father Reuel, he said, "How is it that you have come back so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian helped us against the shepherds. He even drew water for us and watered the flock." He said to his daughters, "Where is he? Why did you leave the man? Invite him to break bread." Moses agreed to stay with the man, and he gave Moses his daughter Zipporah in marriage. She bore a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been an alien residing in a foreign land." And then we return to the plight of the slaves. Just a little mini episode explains how Moses happened to find a wife out in his travels as a fugitive. Ultimately, this The story explains a couple things that will occur later. Later on in the wilderness sojourn, you may recall that Aaron and Miriam object to the fact that Moses doesn't have a wife of their own people, that he is married to a foreigner, and they are punished for raising this objection. And so we have all this curious goings on about foreign wives and so forth all through the Torah, the Pentateuch, and this is, in a way, just a piece of that. But there's something a whole lot more important going on here, as some of you know, if you, for example, have studied Robert Alter's work on the art of biblical narrative. This is one of several stories of betrothals at a well. And we're going to do a quick rehearsal of these, and then relate them to call stories. The first of these to appear is actually in the book of Genesis. So if you'll return just for, or go back just for a moment to Genesis chapter 24. It's a story that's 60-some verses long, and we're not going to read it in its entirety, though that would be fun because it's a great story. We're going to do a little summarizing here for the sake of time. This is the story of Abraham by now, after Genesis 17, dispatching a servant to get a wife for Isaac. And not a wife from among the peoples who now surround them where they're living in the new land, but a wife from back in the homeland, a wife from our people. And so the servant goes back to the old country, back to the east, and takes with him all manner of things with which to broker a deal for a wife for Isaac, and he prays that just the right woman will come along. And he arrives at a well, and sure enough, just as he finishes his prayer, along comes Rebecca. And verse 15, you might look at for a moment. Before he had finished speaking his prayer, there was Rebecca, born to Bethuel, son of Milcah, the wife of Nahor, Abram's brother, coming out with her water jar on her shoulder. The girl was very fair to look upon, a virgin whom no man had known. She went down to the spring, filled her jar, came up. The servant ran to meet her and said, "Please let me sip a little water from your jar." "Drink, my lord," she said, and quickly lowered her jar upon her hand and gave him a drink. Well, the man decides that, yes, indeed, this woman is the answer to his prayers. And so he begins a discussion with her. And at verse 28, the girl ran and told her mother's household about these things. Rebekah had a brother whose name was Laban. Laban ran out to meet the man, and as soon as he'd seen the nose ring and the bracelets on his sister's arms, it's the money that interests Laban, which will be very true to his character. He's now exceedingly interested in this whole business, and invites the servant in for hospitality, and they eat and they negotiate, and at the end of the negotiation for what price will be left with Laban, they finally decide we better ask Rebecca. And so at verse 58 they call Rebecca and they say to her, "Will you go with this man?" And she says, "I will." And so they sent away their sister Rebecca and her nurse, along with Abraham's servant. They bless her, they leave, and in verse 62, we see the scene, and following, we see the scene of Isaac witnessing the arrival of the caravan, the camels and so forth, bringing Rebecca back to be his wife. All right, that's another story of a betrothal that takes place at a well. The next one happens in Genesis 29. Jacob is on a journey. And you know why Jacob's on a journey? He's not in his usual place either, because he has cheated his brother. True to his name, Jacob's name means that he will best you, he will supplant you, he'll get ahead of you. Some people translate it, he'll cheat you. And he has just managed to pull that off against his brother, and so he is fleeing. And he came to the land of the people of the east. So he too is back where the ancestors came from. And he looked and he saw a well in the field and three flocks of sheep lying there beside it. For out of that well the flocks were watered. The stone on the well's mouth was large, and when all the flocks were gathered there, the shepherds would roll the stone from the mouth of the well and water the sheep and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob speaks to these people and makes connections with them and what family they're from. Along comes in verse 6, Rachel. Man he's talking to says, look, it's still broad daylight. It's not the time for the animals to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go pasture them. But they said, we can't until all the flocks are gathered together and the stone is rolled from the mouth of the well when we water the sheep. But while he was still speaking, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. And when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of his mother's brother Laban, and the sheep of his mother's brother Laban, Jacob went and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of his mother's brother Laban. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and wept aloud, and Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman, Rebekah's son, and she ran and told her father. When Laban heard about this, he ran to meet this next generation fellow, embraced him and kissed him and brought him to the house, and they have hospitality and they negotiate, and Jacob gets a bride. Except, as we know, in Jacob's case, it doesn't quite work out as planned. On the wedding night, Laban deceives Jacob, and Leah is the wife with him in the tent in the morning, and so he has to serve some more for the woman that he really intended to have. Well, just like with those call narratives, three of these is enough that you undoubtedly notice you have exactly the same sequence of events in all three stories that we've looked at. An Israelite man is traveling outside his home territory, either by design or because of being a fugitive, comes to a well, meets a woman at the well. It may or may not be the time for watering, but watering begins to happen one way or another at this well, involving both the woman and the man who is there. In each case, the woman or women run home and tell their household, we met this man. And the response is, well, where is he? Bring him here. Let's have hospitality. And the man comes to the household, has hospitality, they talk, and the man ends up with a bride. So that if you are an Israelite man traveling outside your home territory and you come to a well, you better be ready. Or vice versa, you know. If you are a woman going to water the flocks that day and there's some guy from a strange place present, heads up. In the scholarly literature that discusses this, these episodes are called type scenes. They are scenes that go in the same pattern, and all literature has these things. This was first described in biblical studies by people who had studied the Iliad and the Odyssey and had identified scenes such as this all through that literature. And lest you think this is only something that ancient people do, we do this same thing in our popular storytelling. We do it in the movies. I'm an old geezer, so the movies I grew up on were the cowboy movies that used to be the only thing on old black and white television on certain parts of every weekend. I mean, that's literally all there was on television, were old cowboy movies, and I think the same few people made all of them because I began to realize I would see the same rocks on the sets in every single one of them, no matter who was in them or what the story was. It was the same place all the time. And every single one of those movies had a scene in it where someone chased someone else on horseback until he finally lassoed him and pulled him down off his horse and beat the snot out of him, and then the world was better, I guess. But the truly most typical type scene of those old movies was the showdown on Main Street, where it was almost always two men, although I don't know, Annie Oakley might have gotten involved in one or two of these, perhaps, but two individuals would stand on either end of Main Street, each with a gun in their holster, and they would draw against each other. And if you're as old as I am, you've seen this many times. And you know how it works. Two guys are going to draw their guns, and whoever shoots first and kills the other guy wins, and the other guy loses, and they haul him off and take his shoes off. I had to get that in there. But as you know, if you know this genre, you know that while everyone knows how that scene works, one guy comes out of the saloon and the other guy comes out of the post office or whatever, and they stand there and everyone else scatters so that no one else is in the streets except these two people, and there's people peering out of windows and whatnot. We're going to see now who's going to die. It's always the same scene, except you also know that something weird is going to happen in every one of them. There's always something you know that's going to be different. This time, what will it be? Sometimes it'll be something as simple as the one of the gunmen will be left-handed instead of right-handed, and the first man won't see the other guy gone because he's looking at the wrong hand. Sometimes the person who's the sheriff or the good guy will be a chicken unable to do this, and somebody from up on the roof of the general store will have a rifle and will shoot the bad guy just as the two draw, and everyone will think the good guy did it, and he'll become a hero, and he'll even become brave because he'll think he did it. But we, the audience, will know the truth. So there's always some permutation on this story. But it's always the same scene, which means that it's not the pattern that stays the same, but the twists on the pattern that the audience really looks for. What filmmakers, narrators, storytellers count on is that you know the pattern, and they can play with it, and they can do something interesting with that pattern. So, what do we have here in in these stories. I've just outlined a pattern. The pattern is precisely the same in each one. What's different about them is what's really important. So having seen how the pattern works, let's think back now for a moment to the one with Isaac and Rebecca. That's the marital couple by the end of this story. What are the oddities of the story of that betrothal?
The servant.
Pardon me?
The servant that acts as the go-between.
Yeah, the servant goes off to do this. Isaac is not even present for his own betrothal. Somebody goes and does it for him. That's very different. Anything else that's...
I think it's weird. He's like a mail order husband for her. I mean, it's sort of an extension of that. She has no idea about this guy except that he's part of her family.
Yeah. Yeah, and she is the one who finally makes the decision in this story.
They asked her what she thought.
In none of the other stories do they bother to ask the woman, will you do this? But in the case of Isaac and Rebecca, they have to ask, will you do this, Rebecca? And she says, I will. If you know the whole story of Isaac and Rebecca, you know that this is precisely how their lives were and how their relationship worked in the whole of their story. Isaac, in his whole life, is Mr. Passive. His father hauled him up on a mountain to kill him. And all he could say was, isn't this odd? And later on, you know, when we don't really see much of him except as a young man, as an old man, he's so easily fooled. He is basically blind and unable to distinguish things well enough to keep the family in order, at least in the way that he would have done it. Meanwhile, who runs the show in that household?
Rebecca.
Yeah, Rebecca, whose name, by the way, means noose. A Rivka in Hebrew is a noose, not of the kind that you hang bad guys with in those cowboy movies I was talking about, but the kind that you laid on the ground and kept hold of one end and then hid out of sight and waited for some unsuspecting critter to step in the circle, and then you and snared it. That kind of noose. So Rebecca's name, and Rebecca gets that name, people gave a person that name, hoping that they would be able to snare, by their beauty, a partner. That was the point of that name. But in Rebecca's case, just like Jacob, she's got the perfect name for who she is. Everybody in her orbit is in her noose. She controls that family. She decides, despite the birth order, who's going to be the heir of the family. She manipulates everything to come out in the way that she wants. And Isaac is just passive through all of this. Jacob and Rachel, what are the twists on that story? They aren't quite as obvious. And we didn't read it. all that carefully. We just moved through it hit and run fashion.
Well, he didn't get the first woman he wanted.
All right, he doesn't get the first woman that he wants, and he has to
stick around,
work his buns off for 7 more years. The little episode of watering itself is different in this one. There's not an easy watering. This stone takes several workers usually to move when it's time for the watering. But Rachel, when she arrives, the time hasn't quite come to take care of this. And Jacob says, well, I can take care of that. And he moves the big old rock all by himself. You know, a little testosterone show for Rachel. This is the story of Jacob's life. Everything Jacob did came the hard way. And Jacob was always manipulating things and trying to best people, but it always, you know, everything always became difficult. And that's the story of his life. Now, the story of Moses' betrothal is very brief. It's the shortest one of these. What are the quirks of this one?
She's away the bad guys.
Yeah. There's a harassment by these other shepherds who come in and would keep Reuel's daughters from doing their work. And Moses intervenes and chases away the nasty bad guys so that these women can do it. And they end up getting home way sooner than usual. The word in Hebrew for what Moses does for those women happens to be the Hebrew word for salvation, Yasha, the word from which Jesus' name comes. The word Joshua comes from it as well. Right, that is the name. Moses saves the women. He doesn't just chase some shepherds away. So, this is who Moses is. He is the person who saves the people, God's agent ultimately, to do that work. So, what these stories do actually is give you a glimpse, at the very least what they do is give you a glimpse of what will be the person's life. In this case, it's just Moses. In the case of Isaac and Rebecca, it's both of them for sure. Their lives are forecast by the way their betrothal story works. And so I think these stories are just as about as much like call narratives as they are simple type scenes that foreshadow. Because one of the things they do is they demonstrate how lives and primary relationships get shaped. How lives get shaped by primary relationships. That's what I wanted to say. And it's interesting who gets a story like this and who doesn't, just like it is with call narratives. Now, in the biblical tradition, basically only prophets get those call narratives that we were looking at yesterday. You don't get at least in the Hebrew Bible, nobody but a prophet gets one of those narratives. Mary gets one in the Gospel of Luke, apparently because one thing she is perceived to be by that narrator is a prophetic figure, one who bears the word of the Lord, eventually at great pain. But these also are call narratives in that they launch people on their path through life. We don't have birth stories for all these people. We do for some of them. Well, I guess we do. We do have birth stories for all three of the ones that we've looked at. But I guess I should add there are more of these than these three obvious ones. The book of Ruth is one of these stories in reverse. This time it's a non-Israelite woman who travels to Israel, and which is the opposite, you know, of the Israelite man traveling outside of Israelite territory. So Ruth, along with Naomi, comes a Moabite into Israelite territory, and she meets up with the Boaz group, and Boaz at one point says to her, "If you need water, my guys will get some for you from the well." And then she's invited in to the dining hall where the barley harvest people are eating at the end of the day, and they share food and wine, and the next thing you know, Ruth is uncovering Boaz's feet. Got it in again. So that's one of these stories. Only it's got, you know, the whole permutation of switched gender and switched place. And many people think the book of Ruth is at least in part about whether or not Israel can stand the presence of foreign women. Saul has one of these stories. King Saul has one of these stories, but it gets short-circuited. When the whole business of Samuel finding him to be king has got started, there's a curious little episode in 1 Samuel 9 where Saul is he's been looking for the family donkeys. This is the funniest story, one of the funniest stories in the Bible. You know, Saul's out there looking for the family donkeys, and unbeknownst to him, Samuel is looking for a king. Even though God says this is the dumbest idea in the history of ideas, but go do it anyway because they won't stand for anything else. So Samuel doesn't know how to pick a king, so he sees this tall guy who looks sort of kingly, or at least he guesses this must be what kingliness looks like. And so he starts following him around, trying to find a time when he can get him in private and slip this on him. And he finds him out there looking for the family donkeys and tells him, you know, you're going to be king. And Saul says, what? You know, and he says, yeah, but don't tell anybody. So then Saul's in this really weird position, you know. He can't find the family donkeys, and then he goes home, and they say, well, did you succeed? And he's got to come home and say, well, no, I didn't find the donkeys. You know, and then he has to bite his lip, because what he wants to say is, but I'm caring. But anyway, when they're out there looking for the donkeys, at one point, these young women come along with water from a well, and this should be the moment when Saul, the first king of Israel, is going to have his betrothal story. And instead, he asks them directions to someplace else, and he goes off in a different direction, and he never gets a complete well story, which is the story of his life. Saul became king, but it didn't work. You know, he got the people partly organized, but the whole thing got short-circuited, and he goes crazy, and God rejects him. And the half-done well story is the story of his life, too.
Two things. One, thinking about today, I was trying to think, where are the wells today? I was thinking of the bar stories, maybe, with the, you know, where people meet their spouses in the bar. Bar genre. Either that or the mall. And the second was thinking about, you made a comment that how the Bartola story, the personality characteristics and the shape of the story that happens at the well prefigures, you know, what is to be of their life. Moses and Zipporah are a little unusual that way in that she kind of disappears. I mean, he leaves her behind when he goes to Egypt, and then when he comes back, he meets up with her, but the meeting is but a verse, and then he goes, spends the rest of the time now with his father-in-law, who's got a different name. But
yeah.
So that's a strange marriage in a way. I mean, it's closer to this marriage in a way. And not that she plays the accordion, but...
That curious little thing in at the end of Exodus 4 where God comes and tries to kill Moses and she saves him. So she does have that one little role, but you're exactly right. She vanishes. She's certainly, except for the fact that she exists at all, she certainly isn't a part of the long wilderness thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, where does she go? And if you think about who gets these stories in the Hebrew Bible, prophets get those other kind of stories. Moses is the only one I know of who gets one of each, a betrothal story and a call narrative. But the people who get the betrothal narratives are normally the people, what's Ruth remembered for? Ruth is remembered for being a person who built up Israel, as did Rachel and Leah. That's how the book of Ruth ends up assessing the meaning of this story. Ruth will be remembered. Well, Ruth and Naomi together will be remembered as people who built up Israel. Rebecca and Isaac are our mother and father ancestors. Same way with obviously Rachel and Jacob and Leah. Why Moses gets one of those is unclear because he's not known for a population. He doesn't have a tribe named for him. We don't think of him so much as a progenitor as a spiritual forerunner. But anyway, one of the real reasons to bring this up is because, again, this is one that the New Testament writers played with, and if you've never done this, it's very interesting now to turn to John chapter 4. Where we have, if you think Jesus was never married, you're wrong. And not because of the Da Vinci Code. And John 4 is also very long. And we will be careful well, we won't have time to read the whole thing, but just in case we're not ready for this story, the gospel prepares us for it back in chapter 3. In verses 22 and following, let's skip ahead a little farther than that. John the Baptist is talking about who he is and who he is not in verses 27 and following. John answered, "No one can receive anything except what has been given from heaven. You yourselves are my witnesses that I said, I am not the Messiah, but I have been sent ahead of him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom. The friend of the bridegroom who stands and hears him, that is the best man, rejoices greatly at the bridegroom's voice. For this reason, my joy has been fulfilled. He must increase, I must decrease." In other words, I'm not the Messiah. I'm not the groom for this wedding. I am the best man, but here comes the groom. And lo and behold, in the very next story, Jesus is traveling outside of his home territory, deciding not to go in his usual pattern because of some of the things that are going on, and he goes through Samaria to a city called Sychar, near the plot of ground Jacob had given to his sons. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired out by his journey, sat down by the well. It was about noon, at which point you should hear, da-da-da-da. We know what will happen next. It is inevitable. If you are a Jewish guy traveling outside of your home territory and you sit down by a well, here we go. A Samaritan woman came to draw water. And Jesus said, "Give me a drink." She's surprised at this because that's not how it would usually work. No Jew is going to ask a Samaritan woman for a drink. Then they discuss what kind of drink this woman could have if she knew exactly who she was talking with, and they discuss this living water that he offers, she would like some. "Give me this water," she says, "so that I may never be thirsty or have to keep coming here to draw water." Then they discuss her marital status. You may have noticed that in at least two of the three stories that we looked at earlier, the availability of the woman is explained very carefully. Rebecca was a virgin whom no one had ever known. She was that. All that means is she's eligible for a betrothal. This woman is not eligible for a betrothal. She has been married five times. The Torah allows you three. But she has been married five times, and she is currently in another relationship. The nature of these relationships are not described in popular treatment. I have often seen her described as a person who broke these relationships. But all it says is that she had been in them. For all we know, she was widowed five times, like the hypothetical woman in that question that the Sadducees bring up to Jesus. But anyway, she's had five relationships end on her already, and now she's in a sixth, about which we know nothing. Then we get some more discussion that's important to the Gospel of John, but not to what we're doing here, about where worship will happen and so forth. Just then in verse 27, the disciples come back and are astonished that Jesus is speaking to a woman. But they're afraid to ask any questions about it. The woman left her jar, verse 28, and went back to the city. So it doesn't say she ran, but she went quick enough that she didn't even take her stuff with her. She said to the people, come and see a man who told me everything I've ever done. Can he be the Messiah? So they left the city and they're on their way to see him. Meanwhile, there was more conversation with the disciples. But they go get Jesus and they bring him to their town, and he goes and has hospitality with them. They spend 2 days with Jesus as their guest. And when the 2 days were over, he went away from that place to Galilee. And that's where the story ends. Now, what are the quirks to this one? Besides the fact that we have a woman who's not eligible,
Jesus gains popularity.
Jesus didn't gain popularity?
He did.
He did. Oh, he did. He gains popularity among the Samaritans.
Yeah, among the Samaritans.
Right, yeah. He begins to collect a following. In fact, they're wanting him as family. If you could, if you extrapolate what it usually means to invite somebody in for hospitality, you don't do that unless you're ready to work something out.
Well, he tells her everything that she's ever done. He seems to know her before they actually meet.
Yeah, her whole history, her whole life is open to him. That would normally connote that someone was a prophet. If you knew. Well,
he approaches her with hands out, asking for something. It wasn't that way in the other stories.
Yeah, it's kind of an opposite. He asks for a drink. And here's, what were you going to say?
It seems like another form of romance between Jesus and the woman, the love relationship of Jesus and his disciples is also almost a continuation. Is that possible?
Yeah. Well, it is certainly the case that in this story, unlike the others, there's lots of conversation between, if that's what you mean by romance. I mean, they're getting to know each other. there's plenty of talk. It's not just, oh my gosh, that Rachel, she's really beautiful. But
is it? I heard the description of John once. Is that John is like a matchmaker, pointing us to Jesus and saying, "Do I have someone for you to fall in love with?"
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Is that possible?
Yeah.
No. Well, it struck me then that she goes and tells. She becomes a person who calls.
Yeah.
Others.
Yeah, she is in effect. She plays a role not totally unlike women in the empty tomb stories. Come and see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, we've talked about the bride and groom here. Well, we have the story that Jesus is the groom and the church is the bride of Christ, and so these Samaritans, they were not a part of the Jews, but they became followers of Jesus, and so they were part of the church.
Yeah.
Looking forward that way.
Right. And one of the things that might be going on by the time the Gospel of John is written is these Christians, you know, who aren't Jews, mm-hmm. Who, by the way, are still over there. I don't want to play guess what I'm thinking here because we only got 5 minutes, but Jesus asks for a drink in this story, and in every other well story, the watering happens. And all they do in this story is talk about it. Nobody gets their drink. Jesus asks for a drink and he doesn't get it. The woman wants this living water, and there's a sense in which we can understand that she may have or must have gotten this eventually, because she becomes this person we've just been discussing, who's a witness and even an inviter. But there's something incomplete about this story. Jesus leaves town without a bride. He doesn't get his drink, and he doesn't leave fully betrothed. Now, the time of the story is always important. Was it the time for watering or not in Jacob's story? They came back sooner than they usually did in the Moses Zipporah story. In this story, it is noon. And when you read the commentaries about this, it's usually pointed out, this is absolutely not when people go to wells. For water anyway, because you're so worried about evaporation. Not to mention just working in the heat. You did this in the early morning, you did this in the evening, you don't do this at noon, or as one famous line once went, what you went to a well for at noon, you didn't take home in a bucket. But that's not really the point of this story. The reason this story happens at noon is because there, as we all know, in John and only in John, at a later point, precisely at noon, Jesus will ask for a drink. In all the other Gospels, Jesus is crucified earlier in the day, 9 o'clock in the morning. In John's Gospel, he's crucified at noon, and only in John does he ask for a drink. This is everything in John's Gospel comes to completion in the crucifixion scene and the passion narrative. So does the becoming the bridegroom. He asks for a drink, and in John's Gospel, he gets it, and he receives it. And what he receives in John's Gospel is not a drink of huenos, regular wine, it's oxus, sour wine, or wine vinegar, as sometimes called, which just happens to be precisely the thing that Ruth gets in her passion narrative, another story of a foreign woman. Chometz, it is in Hebrew, translated in the Septuagint as oxus. So John is playing with these stories. And Jesus gets his bride on the cross. And so this, he doesn't have a baptism story in John's Gospel. But he's got a betrothal story. This is the story, in a way, that calls him to his task. That sets him on the journey of receiving his bride. And who is he in the Johannine volume 4 or 5 or whatever you want to call it that we call Revelation? He is the bridegroom. And how does he get to be the bridegroom? What right does the book of Revelation have to call him the bridegroom? Well, here was the wedding. Here was the betrothal, the crucified. And the bride comes to meet him dressed in baptismal garb. So, another kind of call story, and another way that the biblical writers play with their stories and work changes on them in order to teach and to preach. We have 20 seconds. Any comments, questions?
In order to teach and to preach, I mean, when it's so esoteric, How is that good teaching and preaching?
Well, these.
I mean, I'm happy to see it as art, poetry.
Yeah.
But well, teaching.
Here's the way I understand this. Those people that John thinks of as his audience in his own day knew those well stories like I know those cowboy stories. And they just knew to look for the changes. You know, this, I like to say back in my classes in Indiana that, you know, this set of stories was the whole collection for most of those people of all the movies and all the novels and all the, and they didn't have any VCRs, so this was it. This was their entertainment, not just their scripture. So this is how they taught and preached and played. Thank you.